I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Corbett, who struggles in the polls against his Democratic challenger, Tom Wolf, has been saying at campaign stops that the state faces a public pension crisis. One of Corbett's ads attacks Wolf for saying there was no crisis. Wolf took issue with that ad and said he would work with the legislature to figure out how to plug the gap, which is about $50 billion. So how did public pensions, not a big priority for voters, according to the polls, become a campaign issue in the Commonwealth? We asked Mark Levy to join us. He's Pennsylvania political reporter for the Associated Press. And Mark Levy, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. When Governor Corbett signed the budget, he criticized the legislature for not dealing with the public pension crisis as he sees it. He is using this issue to try to hammer his challenger, Tom Wolf. Why do you think the governor has taken on this issue of public pensions?
Well, I think the political analysts who are watching this issue closely see him as trying to show himself to be a man of action on what he believes is a very important issue to a broad spectrum of people, and only in the last few weeks, at the end of June, did he begin linking this in very explicit terms to property tax increases. And in a sense, this gives him the chance to run against property taxes, which is a very unpopular tax in Pennsylvania, deeply, deeply unpopular in certain pockets, perhaps a little more under the radar in Philadelphia, where people pay a significant wage tax. But He's trying to make this into something that affects everybody and to show himself that he is the governor. He's the guy who's trying to do something about this.
It's a pretty wonky issue. I do believe it's an important issue, but it's a pretty wonky one for people to understand. Would you agree with that?
Well, the political consultants who I've talked to about this probably for the past couple of years have generally all agreed that it's a difficult issue for the public to understand. It's difficult to sum up in a soundbite. It's obscure. It's complicated. The legislation and pensions are all very complicated stuff. But I think, you know, what the analysts believe that Tom Corbett is doing is boiling it down to something that everyone can understand, which is your rising property taxes and pensions are the reason. And that's his way of making this into something that everyone can latch onto and grasp and understand and be motivated by.
And what we're talking about, and this has to do with public pensions, is that the obligations outweigh the assets, correct?
That's right. And for a long time, we've known that for, you know, going on 12, 13 years in this Capitol building, people have talked about the coming pension wave. And policymakers here have found ways to put off the pain of higher payments until 2010, when a law was passed which set a schedule that said, you know, the state's got to come back into compliance with its actuarially sound payments. And that's what's happening now, is we're seeing payments rise until it gets to a point where it's supposed to be, where actuaries say it's supposed to be. And it's causing budgetary pain for school districts and the state.
And we're talking about a gap of, what, almost $50 billion?
Yeah, it's right. It's right almost on $50 billion. We're talking about the state's two major public employee pension systems. That's the state employees retirement system and the public school employees retirement system. Roughly 700,000 current employees and retirees benefit from these two systems.
Let's go back to, I guess it was during when the time when Tom Ridge was the governor of Pennsylvania, and the legislature and the governor signed off on voting to increase lawmakers' pensions, I think by something like 50%, and teachers by about 25%. Mark, take us back to that time and place.
Well, you know, the stock market was doing really well, and I wasn't here in Harrisburg at the time, but the reading I've done, shows that the administration says that lawmakers were very interested in getting a pension boost. And you're right, Marty, that in 2001 a law was passed that gave everyone a big pension boost, and it not only going forward, but it also was retrospective to when they began their employment. So it was a significant boost, and a couple years later, the retirees came and said, what about us? And there was a a cost of living boost for them that also added a couple billion dollars onto the tab. Now, that's one leg of a three-legged stool that is contributing to what we call the unfunded liability, the pension debt. The other two legs are the horrendous investment losses that everyone experienced during the dot-com bubble and then the Great Recession, and state government essentially finding ways to put off payments for about a decade. That's why we have the unfunded liability, as we call it, the pension debt of about $50 billion. Of course, that first pension increase, that big benefit boost in 2001, came before the market collapsed, before that dot-com bubble collapsed. And back then, you know, something like that was kind of unforeseeable. It was unthinkable, really.
Was this passed in the middle of the night, quote-unquote, in the middle of the night? Was there public discussion about increasing these pensions? Do you know?
You know, like I said, I wasn't there at the time, but it was negotiated in the back room. There weren't, you know, legislative hearings on it. It seemed to happen like a lot of things happen in Harrisburg, which is that the agreements are struck in back rooms between legislative leaders and the governor. And, you know, within days, this is written into legislation and passed and becomes law.
And what is Corbett's proposal to reform or fix this problem as he sees it?
So the legislation that he's been backing this year was the actuarial note on it attached by a state agency said that it would save about $10 to $14 billion over 30 years. The idea being is that for future employees only, your traditional pension benefit would top off at about $25,000 a year. After that, you would be given a kind of like a 401k style plan, and you get a 4% contribution to that.
That doesn't seem like a lot of savings.
It's, you know, compared to the 2010 law, what it did was it pared back benefits to some of them to pre-2001 levels. The savings estimated from that would have been about $33 billion over 30 years, but much of that savings was eaten up in deferred payments, so giving states and school districts time to work up to where they needed to be so that it wasn't a kind of like a shock to the budgets all at once.
Is the Republican Party or are Republicans in the legislature also interested in taking on or tackling this issue?
Well, this legislation backed by the governor had a majority of Republicans backing it in the legislature. It did not have enough votes to get through the Republican-controlled legislature. Democrats are against it. Unions are against it. And what you had was enough Republicans who felt that it wasn't fair to do a pension legislation predicated simply on taking away benefits. And there were some Republicans who felt that it provided no immediate savings to their school districts and they couldn't support it, and it hasn't gotten across the finish line.
Well, interestingly, you talk about a number of school districts. Some of them, in fact, Tim Potts, who was a guest on our show last week, who's on the school board in Carlisle District, he said back in 2001, his district paid about $209,000 towards pensions, and this year it's $4.2 million. And the districts are having to pick up a lot of this tab.
Well, they split it with the state, so it's the split with the state is roughly 55-45. But you're right. The figures I compiled from state documents show that in 2002, states and the state and schools were basically putting in almost nothing. In the 2003 school year, it was about $20 million. This fiscal year, they are expected to put in a combined about $2.9
billion. $2.9 billion, almost $3 billion.
Right. And the tab will go up by another $1.5 billion over the next 3 years.
Do the unions feel like they are being targeted by the governor's calling for reform of pensions?
The unions have said that, you know, look, we dealt with this in 2010. There was a law that everyone agreed to. It was bipartisan. It reduced benefits. and we should live by that law and let it work. And so under that law, within the next 3 or so years, the state and school districts would be at the point where they are paying in the actuarial number that they're supposed to be paying in. It would level off for about 20 years and then start to decline after that. And within 30 years, in theory, if everything else goes according to plan, the pension debt would be gone.
And it's interesting. I mean, Pennsylvania is not the only state that's dealing with this problem of public pensions.
That's right. There's a number of other states whose major pension funds are in similar straits, and you know, the Great Recession had a tremendous effect on that, on investments. But there are a number of other states whose major pension funds are in the neighborhood of 60% funded, which is where PSERS and SERS, as we call them, the public school and state employees retirement systems in Pennsylvania, that's where they're funded at about 60%.
We have an email from Joseph. He said, did Governor Rendell do anything to help? Mark?
Well, I guess help what is the question, but what the governor did is every year he was increasing money for public schools, but he and the legislature at that time were putting in less than the number they were being told by actuaries that they need to put into the pension funds. There was also a law passed while Rendell was governor that tightened the rules on when school districts on how much school districts could increase property taxes.
I mean, it sounds like everyone was banking on good times on Wall Street. Obviously, as you said, that the dot-com collapse and also the recession of 2009 and the collapse on Wall Street, that sort of double whammy has really hurt the state hard.
That's right. And in the years after the dot-com bubble, Governor Rendell and the legislature passed a law that put off some of the payments that were going to be due. And the theory was, let's let the stock market recover, because what happened in the dot-com bubble is not going to repeat itself. The stock market will recover, and eventually, you know, our payments into the pension funds will ease. But, you know, as we all know now, there was another horrendous collapse in the market. And what, you know, a lot of policymakers in this building have been warning about in the years in between came true. So, you know, none of this was necessarily unexpected. It was just a question of when and how much the state was going to have to pay.
Well, Mark, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. That's Mark Levy, Pennsylvania political reporter for the Associated Press. And we called him up because Governor Corbett has been touring the state, emphasizing what he calls Pennsylvania's pension crisis. And we're talking about where this came from, possible solutions. And we want to hear from you. Is this a campaign issue that you can sign on to? I guess that's a dangling modifier there. You can give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. We'll be right back.
The Association for Public Art supports WHYY and announces Magic Carpet, July 16th through August 17th. Philadelphia artist Candy Coated transforms the Oval into a magical environment of color, pattern, illusion, and movement. Visitors are transported into another world with colorful sandboxes, 3D illusion art, and more right on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. Magic Carpet, July 16th through August 17th. More information at associationforpublicart.org/magic-carpet.
Successful parents often leave their children with some pretty big shoes to fill, but that doesn't mean they have to wear them.
If you end up going into a field your parent is really successful in, you've got to push away to find out who you are. Maybe I did it a little longer than was necessary.
That's the classic singer-songwriter Roseanne Cash. Join us as she discusses her family legacy and her own brand of rock and roll this week on Sound Opinions.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Hi there, I'm Gian Gomeshi, the host of Q. Tune in to Q each day for your dose of arts, culture, and entertainment, from live music and feature chats with compelling cultural figures to debates on the issues of the day. Q has got you covered. That's coming up from PRI, Public Radio International. Weeknights at 9, beginning August 4th on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Barney Moscowen. Governor Corbett, incumbent here in Pennsylvania, has been touring the state, claiming that the state faces a public pension crisis, also charging that his challenger, Tom Wolf, is minimizing the problem. And we asked Mark Levy, a Pennsylvania political reporter for the AP, to help us understand what the governor is talking about and the nature of this problem or this slash crisis. And again, we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes at whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And in just a couple of minutes, we'll be talking about the Affordable Care Act. Going back to you, Mark Levy, so what has been Tom Wolf's response to Tom Corbett's charge? And there's been an ad out there basically saying that Wolf is saying there is no problem here in Pennsylvania.
Right. Well, Tom Wolf has his own ideas on how to deal with this. You can argue whether or not he views it as a crisis, that the governor wants to portray Tom Wolf as not viewing this as a crisis. I guess that's, in a sense, more or less, a word that has, you know, not a whole lot of meaning if you're still trying to solve the problem. What Tom Wolf wants to do is, he said he would consider a pension bond. He has said he wants to raise taxes on things like the natural gas drilling industry, a variety of other things that would bring in money to the state, so that the state could send more money to public schools to help them in that way. And what Tom Wolf points out is, you know, look, the biggest part of the unfunded liability is the state's inaction on paying its fair share on what it was due over the past decade.
And we should add that Moody's has downgraded the state's bond rating, citing, quote-unquote, large and growing public pension liabilities.
That's right. So Pennsylvania has seen three downgrades, two from Moody's, one from Fitch, in the last 2 years. Pension liabilities is one part of what's being cited. The state's budget is also running a structural deficit year after year, and the rising pension costs is part of that.
Let me get, looks like Carol from Ridley Park to join our conversation. And Carol, go ahead, you're on Radio Times.
Oh, good morning.
Good morning.
I would like your guests to comment on the pension formula for the state worker union, as well as the public school employees. They retire at 70%, and that was done by Governor Ridge back in 2001, 70% of their last 3 years. They have pensions roughly 60, 70, 80,000. Some of them, depending on years of service, are retired at their full salary.
Can you speak to that, Mark?
Sure. There's a lot of different types of people in this system. The average teacher, the average school, state employee retires with about a $25,000 a year pension after running a top salary of about $50,000. Now, there are pensions, pension benefits that are much more generous than that. That's for the higher paid people in the system, such as university professors, judges, lawmakers, executive branch, top executive branch officials. The match that most state employees get going forward is 2% a year of salary.
2% for a year of salary. Carol, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We have another email. This is from Ray, saying that retirees are living longer. The third leg of the problem is temporary, same as Social Security. I guess there's maybe a fourth leg on the stool, the fact that people are living longer. Is that a factor, you think, Mark?
Sure. I'm sure it's a driver in retirement costs everywhere. The analysis of the existing pension debt, though, is predicated on three things. The analysis that I've seen, and like I said, it has to do with the state failing to live up to what it needed to pay in, investment losses against what the state expected to get in investments, and pension benefit increases.
And just to make sure our listeners understand, so if it's split between school districts and the state, districts are paying their fair share, but the state is not when it comes to actually putting money into the system?
The state essentially dictates what everybody puts into the system. So nobody's been paying what they actually really should have been putting in, school districts or the state. In several years, it will the school districts and the state will hit the point at which they are putting into this, putting into the pension funds that they should have been. Right now, for instance, this year, the state and school districts are scheduled to put in about $2.9 billion. You compare that to, say, 2006 when it was below $500 million, and in 3 years when it will be well above $4.4 billion.
I mean, at some point, it seems it's going to have to be dealt with in Pennsylvania.
It has to be.
I mean, this is unsustainable, as you describe it, Mark.
Right. And, you know, policymakers in the Capitol, lawmakers in the Capitol seem as though they are no longer willing to put off the payments that are due under the 2010 law. And it's becoming increasingly painful for school districts and the state. And but as the pension professionals will tell you, there's only one way to lower your payment right now, and that's by reducing the benefits of people who are already in the system, people who are already employed or who are already retired. And there is constitutional law that guides against that. That something like that would never survive in the courts.
Or raising taxes, right? Wouldn't that be the other part?
Yeah, that's obviously something else that can be done.
Let me get one more call.
And I guess the governor would say is being done at the local level by school districts.
And this is where we get back to then the property tax. Let me get Mark to join us. Mark, our final caller, as we talk about pensions and Pennsylvania. Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I live in New Jersey, but I see a lot of similarities between the Pennsylvania and New Jersey unfunded pension systems. I guess my comment more than a question would be, and I'd be interested in your guest take on it, is over the years there have been countless deferments on the part of state government pay their liabilities into pension systems, whereas the employees that are part of those pension systems are unable to defer their payments into it, regardless of their financial situation. And they don't have a choice. They can't say, I'm short this year. I'll catch you in a couple of years and catch up on my liability to my pension system. And I'd be interested in your guest's take on that.
Mark, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Mark, is it different in Pennsylvania than in New Jersey?
Well, it's my understanding that the employees pay in and have been paying in. You'll hear that from the unions and Democrats that the teachers and the state employees have been paying what they're supposed to put into the pension funds, which in most cases is in the range of 6 to 7% of their salary.
Well, on that note, Mark Levy, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times, talking about a complicated issue, making it quite understandable. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. He's Pennsylvania political reporter for the Associated Press. The Affordable Care Act is facing yet another challenge with two conflicting court rulings last week about the use of subsidies for buying health insurance on federal exchanges. One court said the subsidies apply only to state-run exchanges, while the other said they should be available to everyone in every state. We asked Mary Agnes Carey, reporter for Kaiser Health News, to clarify these decisions and to get us up to speed on the implementation of the Affordable Care Act 4 years after its passage. And Mary Agnes Carey, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
Quite a week last week. We've got these two, I guess, dueling, conflicting court decisions having to do with exchanges and subsidies in the Affordable Care Act. Let's start with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. This was a 2-1 opinion. What did the court say?
What the court said is the way they read the legal statute of the Affordable Care Act, the actual law that passed, that the subsidies, this is the amount of money that are given to eligible individuals to help them purchase coverage and in some cases help with their cost sharing, their out-of-pocket costs, that those subsidies could be delivered only in states that set up their own health insurance exchanges. And that's a really significant finding because only 14 states in the District of Columbia have set up their own exchanges. For the remaining 36 states, those are run by the federal government. So if that ruling stood, and it's very unclear whether it will or not, people in federal exchanges would lose their subsidies, which would really wreak havoc with the law.
And is there a sentence in the many thousands or many pages of the Affordable Care Act that says just that?
What it says is that there's one sentence that says exchanges would be available, subsidies be available through an exchange established by the state. But as you continue to read the law, there are phrases talking about if the state didn't set up an exchange, the federal government, through the Department of Health and Human Services, would stand in the shoes of, in place of the state. And so proponents of the law, and many legal scholars as well, have said if you read the law thoroughly and you look at when the Internal Revenue Service made its interpretation that the law intended to have subsidies available in every state, that the reading of the circuit court here in District of Columbia is far too narrow. But again, these are the courts, lots of different interpretations.
Well, there was then also the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond. I mean, it sounds like their reading is not only just different from what the D.C. District Court said or ruled, but also more in line with the Obama administration.
That's exactly right. As we were in the middle of figuring out the D.C. Circuit Court ruling last week, literally within an hour and a half to 2 hours, this Richmond ruling came down, voted 3-0 to uphold the Affordable Care Act, its current interpretation by the administration, that subsidies are available to everyone. So that was definitely a ruling in the favor of the administration. And we should say, for the ruling here in the District of Columbia, the administration has said it's going to ask the full district court here in Columbia to look at the ruling. It only takes 6 judges to vote to do it of the 11-judge panel. And of the district court ruling here, here in D.C., it's 7 Democrats, 4 Republicans. Mm. So the thought is if it goes to that full panel, that they may very well rule in favor of the administration, which would mean you don't have tension in the circuit courts. That's usually when the Supreme Court gets involved, if they see, you know, different rulings back and forth. But they've got, the administration has something like 45 days to take this action. They say they're going to. So the outcome of that full district court review is going to take a while.
And is the language in the Affordable Care Act, is it that confusing and ambiguous? And could Congress, not that it would, but could Congress rewrite or clarify some of this language that might clarify these court rulings?
It certainly would have helped matters if during drafting they threw in a sentence that said, oh, by the way, no matter whether it's a state exchange or a federal exchange, that the subsidies are available. So that definitely could have definitely helped things. Typically on Capitol Hill, the House passes a version of the bill, the Senate passes a version, and both chambers sit down and have a conference. That's what's happening right now on the Veterans Affairs legislation, where the two chambers appoint members and resolve differences. We never had that with the health care law. Mm. And as you may or may not remember, when it was passed, it was done in both the House and the Senate with totally Democratic votes. So that has created a real bit of friction, as we know, politically, the views of the ACA and so on. But an implementation of any law, especially one this big, you have bumps in the road. You need members of Congress to do things like technical corrections bills and so on. And there's been absolutely no real bipartisanship on these big issues of fixing the law. So to your point, Congress
they could,
technically,
right?
They could, but let's face it, they're not going to, because Republicans have used these court rulings, particularly the D.C. ruling here, as fodder for their, you know, their concerns about the health care law. They want it repealed. They want it done away with and so on. Many of them do. And so this has been another weapon in their arsenal against the law.
But would it be fair to say 5 years ago when people were still writing this and that the administration and those who wrote the Affordable Care Act assumed that states would set up their exchanges and maybe are surprised that so few did?
They sure did. That was definitely the thought. The thought was governors, state legislatures are not going to want the federal government in their backyard setting up something as big as a health insurance exchange that's going to affect millions of people. But as we know now over the last 5 years, things have played out a little differently than anticipated on the health care law, the political opposition by many Republican governors and legislatures and in some voters' minds have been so strong that you've had Republicans in many of these states not only not set up the health insurance exchanges, but we have about half the states in the country that haven't done the health law's Medicaid expansion. Mm. So the opposition here has been far stronger than they envisioned. But to your point about the drafters of the bill, one story I thought that was really interesting last week done here in Washington was a story looking at staffers who wrote the health care law. And even a Republican staffer that was quoted in the story said, we fully intended exchanges to be given through a state-run exchange or a federally run exchange. I thought that was really compelling to look at that. And then also one of the front of the court briefs submitted by drafters of the law probably well over a year ago said we absolutely intended for the subsidies to be given out no matter whether it's state-run exchange or federal-run exchange.
Does that mean that the D.C. Circuit Court was nitpicking this law? If that was the intention, and it's hard to imagine that people were thinking, yeah, this group of people get subsidies and this group of people don't. I mean, it's hard to imagine thinking that way. But do you think the court is nitpicking?
What the court was saying is, and I'm going to strongly paraphrase here, that the idea of taking money away from people who currently have subsidies, who get subsidies and who don't, really isn't our prerogative, that Congress wasn't clear enough. And there are people that say their interpretation of this was a reasonable interpretation, but since it's come out, the amount of legal experts and, again, the members of Congress that wrote the law, the staffers that worked on it, has been so overwhelming to say we intended subsidies no matter who ran the exchange, I think is certainly adding a lot of intensity to the debate. And it's really important now to focus on, will that whole D.C. Circuit, that 11-judge panel, take this up, and how will they rule on what that 3-judge panel within the court ruled on?
Is there any question that they would or wouldn't take it up?
Technically, they could vote not to do it. If they decide that it's an issue they want to take a pass on and they want to kick it up to the Supreme Court, they certainly could. But the conventional wisdom here by people who know that court better than I do is they think that they will take it up and that their full ruling will back up the administration's interpretation that subsidies are available no matter who runs the exchange.
We're almost up on a break here. Are there other court challenges making their way through different district courts?
Absolutely. There's similar cases pending in courts in Oklahoma and Indiana. And so I don't know when those rulings are going to come down, but those will certainly add more ammunition to this debate no matter what they rule.
That's Mary Agnes Carey, our guest in the second half of Radio Times this hour. She's a reporter for Kaiser Health News. We often call her up to clarify bits and pieces and parts and decisions related to the Affordable Care Act. And we've been talking about two rather contradictory court rulings last week having to do with exchanges and subsidies. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. We'll be right back.
A fresh look at Pennsylvania's distressed cities.
There are a lot of people that really care about this city.
Stories of reinvention as communities face rust or revival.
We will change our neighborhoods with them or without them.
WHYY's Keystone Crossroads, a statewide public media partnership where you are part of the conversation.
There was nothing to look forward to. Now we have some hope.
WHYY.org/Keystone Crossroads. Made possible by a generous grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
On the next Fresh Air, George Takei of Star Trek fame has a new documentary about his life. He was 5 when his family was sent to a Japanese-American internment camp during World War II.
There were tall sentry towers with machine guns pointed at us. When I made the night runs to the latrine, searchlights followed me.
Takei will also talk about coming out as gay at age 68. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Inner demons, everybody has them, and they certainly get in the way of our well-being. This is the voice that tells us we can't succeed. We're just not good enough. We may forgive others when they make mistakes, but certainly not ourselves. So, how can we deal with those negative voices that live inside of all of us? I'm Dan Gottlieb, and on the next Voices in the Family, Taming Your Inner Critic. That's today at noon here on WHYY-FM.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with Mary Agnes Carey, reporter for Kaiser Health News, and we've been talking about the dueling court decisions last week having to do with subsidies and the Affordable Care Act and exchanges. We're also going to get up to speed on where the health insurance program stands today. And again, taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Rob from Northern Liberties to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Rob. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome.
I wanted to ask your guest, I'm under the impression that previous either state or federal courts have come down with opinions on this question, and that everyone up until the District of Columbia had decided in line with the Fourth Circuit in Richmond. Is that correct or not?
That is I beg your pardon. Sure. Yeah, that is correct. And that's why that District Court of Appeals ruling here in D.C. was such a bombshell last week. Your guest is absolutely right. There's been prior court rulings that have sided with the administration, that have discounted the opponent's arguments that the law was intended only to give exchanges, subsidies in the state exchanges. And so, that's why that D.C. ruling was such a big deal.
Rob, thanks for the call to Radio Times. And I guess it also tells us how important the D.C. Court of Appeals is within that constellation.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about it is that it – obviously, if you are undertaking a court challenge, you go to every avenue you can get, right? And so when you went to the Court of Appeals, they're appealing prior rulings, and that this ruling now, if it would stand by the full panel, I know we just talked about that, the thought is it wouldn't, but now you have, if you are an opponent of the health law, if you are an opponent of exchange money, subsidies rather, going to every exchange, then this is a big victory for you. So it's certainly one spot in the ledger, but there are many other prior rulings that side with the administration.
I noticed the dissenting judge, Harry Edwards, said that this ruling was an attempt to gut the Affordable Care Act.
Right. And we've heard that. It's certainly in that dissent. It's certainly in other discourse about the health law, because opponents have tried a variety of legislative maneuvers. Some of them have gone to states discouraging them from setting up health insurance exchanges. They've tried every avenue because, let's face it, if you want to get rid of the law, you really need to do it before millions of people are getting exchanges, getting subsidies rather, even though millions are getting it right now, or before every state takes that Medicaid expansion. The more it's implemented and the more people that benefit, the harder it's going to be to overturn it.
And how many people today are getting those subsidies?
In the federal exchange, there's about 5.4 million people on the federal exchange, and more than 4 million people get those subsidies. And they're fairly significant across all metal levels. That's the gold, platinum, silver, and bronze. They're reducing premiums by like 76%.
Wow.
And then if you get a silver plan, that's the subsidies are really tied to the second lowest cost silver plan, it's dropping those premiums down to something like $69, $70 a month. So this is a lot of money that affects a lot of lives.
And while these courts try to figure out their decisions, are those subsidies affected in any way for those individuals?
They are not. They stay in place until there's a final ruling on the matter. So the Obama administration made that very clear last week. I did a Q&A on this that got a lot of pickups, a lot of interest to try to make that clear to folks. You don't have anything to worry about. You have a subsidy now. You're fine, and let this thing play out in the courts.
And how many people have signed up since the rocky rollout of last fall?
There's about 8 million people that have signed up for the exchanges, and I think it's around 6 million or so that have signed up for the Medicaid expansion. So even with all the problems on healthcare.gov, and then we've had a lot of problems between healthcare.gov and some of the state Medicaid programs and getting that information and so on, you've still had a fairly strong enrollment. And then the thought is, as the next enrollment begins this November, the federal officials keep saying they're working out the kinks. They won't have the same problems with the healthcare website that they had that got so much attention when it initially rolled out. So we'll see if it plays out the way they say, but you have a significant enrollment now, and the thought is if consumers can still get choice, if you still have options for coverage, if you can see your own provider, if you have a good network, and there have been some health plans that have more narrow networks, depending how that works out, they can anticipate enrollment to continue.
Adding those two together, you're talking about something like 14 million people?
So far, yes.
And does that mean that they are signed up, they're paid up, they're in the system, they're seeing their health care provider?
That is a great question. The federal government website, healthcare.gov, yet doesn't have the back end of the site built. So for them to know if people are paying or not, they're getting that information from insurers. Private insurers are reporting the payment rates in the exchange are similar to those outside the exchange. Yeah. They're in the 80 to 90%, right? So that's one thing to note. They seem that people are paying their premiums. And then also what's happening now is people are starting to go to the providers, get the coverage. My colleague Julie Appleby today had a very interesting story about how people thought the doctors they were seeing were in the plans they enrolled in, then when they go to see them, they find out they haven't been. So some plans have done these things called narrow networks where they're minimizing the amount of providers or hospitals you can see. This practice was before the Affordable Care Act, but it's definitely being used in some of the exchanges. So it's one of those things that we're starting to see as people use the coverage. Some people are thrilled with it. If they've never had it, they didn't have coverage, they're happy. Other people have had some experiences that have not been as pleasant. So we're seeing all sorts of stories play out.
And has the actual rate of uninsured people in the United States, has that gone down as a result of these people signing up?
There are several studies that point to that. The Urban Institute has noted a drop in coverage. Last week, the New England Journal of Medicine reported it had a study that came out that also reported, I think, about a 5% drop. But we're waiting for more official statistics on that from the federal government.
And I know there was a call not just to get uninsured people into the system, but to get these young, healthy, invincibles in the system. And Mary Agnes, any way to know whether that was an effective campaign to get them in? Because, of course, young healthies help the old unhealthies.
They do. And they've had a fairly good take-up rate with that. But the bigger point to that, I think, is you have to have a what they call a risk pool. That's all the covered lives, all the people that are getting coverage. It really needs to be balanced, not only for young and old, but for healthy and sick. You need a broad risk pool there. And so it's the young invincibles, as we call them. They're certainly important, but you also need to have a broader pool of healthier folks in there to help balance those costs.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Mary Agnes Carey. She's a reporter for Kaiser Health News, and we are talking about the Affordable Care Act. And there were some dueling court decisions last week that caused some confusion, raised some questions, which we have been talking about. And now we're getting up to speed on sort of where things stand with the Affordable Care Act. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. Again, send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We actually have a Facebook comment from Ed. He says, Mary Agnes, for the life of me, I just don't see what some have against the Affordable Care Act, unless it's just pure politics or hatred of a particular politician. Are you surprised at how, I guess, controversial the Affordable Care Act still is today?
Not necessarily, because Congress has gotten more partisan over the years, and there's been that philosophical divide against debating the role of government in the healthcare system or in any other part of our lives still remains fairly strong. So it doesn't necessarily surprise me that many Republicans still dislike the Affordable Care Act. But I think you have to look at some of the polls as well. While public is saying don't repeal it, there are the favorable, unfavorable views on the health care law are fairly split. So I don't know if it's an example of once we get past the midterms are coming up or the next presidential cycle, will there ever be a period of time on the Hill, for example, where some of the Republican opponents of the health law will simply say, gosh, it's been here for X amount of years. Let's get in there, fix what we dislike, and move on to other issues. But it's been a political winter for opponents. And when you're in, you're fighting for control of the Senate or you're fighting for control of the White House or the House or whatever, you're going to use everything you can to help you maintain your advantage. And the Affordable Care Act has been a really strong one for Republicans.
Is there any evidence that companies that provide health insurance for their employees are getting out of that part of the business and saying to their employees, just go to the exchanges and sign up and, in a sense, be on your own?
There are isolated reports of that, but no overall trend that we have found.
What does that tell you? Or does it tell us anything?
Most large employers, 100 or more, want to provide health insurance, and they do it. For example, it's something like 96% of employers do that. So the key here is really looking at people in the individual market, 13, 14, 15 million people who'd been buying health insurance on their own, and small businesses that some had been providing health insurance, some had not. Some view the Affordable Care Act as a way to do that or as a way not to do it. So I think that We sort of think about the Affordable Care Act and the entire universe of workers, but for many of us in larger companies, 100 or more workers, most of those employers are already providing health insurance.
Would it be fair to say we have the most complicated healthcare system in the entire world?
I would think so. I would think so. I don't know every single country's healthcare system, but I can tell you this one's pretty complicated.
And complicated because it seems almost like a wildebeest. I mean, we keep adding pieces onto a basic system rather than, I guess, streamlining or simplifying the system as it has evolved over time. Maybe that's impossible. I don't know.
But even something as simple as, unless you're in a closed panel health maintenance organization, right? Unless you're in, you get your health care from a group of providers that all work in the same place. Just trying to get one doctor to get the records of the blood test of one doctor to another doctor is incredibly hard. A lot of paperwork. It seems foolish. There are many times I've said, I don't need this particular test. I already had that test, but the onus is always on me to go get the MRI, to bring it to the specialist, to show that person that I don't need it. There just seems to be layers of complication in our system that we just don't need to have.
Well, speaking of things like e-records, I know a number of physicians who are, I think, literally tearing their hair out trying to get all those paper folders, filled with reports into an integrated computer system, and it's really hard.
It is really hard. I mean, if you decide you now want to have electronic health care record and you know what's going to work for you and what's going to be interactive, perhaps, with specialists or other physicians that your patients do business with, you're right. You've got all those paper files. We all see it when we go to the doctor. Mm. Who do you pay to put that in there? And how much time does that take? And it's incredibly frustrating. But I think maybe the way to look at it is, where are we going to be 10 years from now, 15 years from now, 20 years from now? Will that be seamless? Will it work more smoothly? Will it be sort of the norm, where we no longer have to sit there and fill that chart out every single time you go to the doctor, but you just have it stored and ready to go, or they can get electronically easily from another physician?
Do you think there are lessons from Medicare, which was implemented a couple of decades ago, that can be applied to the Affordable Care Act?
I think that the key lesson there is it takes time, and sometimes things change. When Medicare was created in 1965, seniors didn't live as long as they do today. It was really viewed as more of a program for indigent seniors. They probably had no idea it would get as big and broad as it has today. But when you talk to people on Medicare, they're fairly happy with it. And it is a program that has financial assistance for poor beneficiaries. So I think that it's always a question of time. And The point here, I guess, is the Affordable Care Act, I'm not saying it's in any danger of being repealed or anything, but it just needs time to play out, and this is where opponents of the law are working fast and furious to try to stop it, because they know, as we talked about before, the longer it plays out, the more buy-in there is, the harder it would be to repeal it.
Do you think calling the Affordable Care Act Obamacare, as many do, including reporters, that hurts the Affordable Care Act or politicizes it?
Well, you know it pulls worse.
It pulls worse.
When you talk about the Affordable Care Act, it pulls more favorably than Obamacare. But you know, about a year or so ago, the president came out and said, you know, I do care. Call it Obamacare.
Well, I heard him say that, and I just thought, you know, I don't know. I try not to do that on the air because I just feel like you need to call things
right.
What they actually are. But people shorthand it all the time, and one
sure.
Wonders whether it doesn't have political partisan implications one way or the other.
I think the 2010 healthcare law is the safest bet. That's how I refer to it a lot when I write about it.
So what do you – we're almost out of time here, Mary Agnes. So what do you have your eyes on in the next couple of weeks or months?
The regulatory process, I know it sounds really boring, but as the Department of Health and Human Services puts out new regulations and guidance on the health law, that's important. Looking at the number of insurers who get in is important. How broad or narrow are their networks? That's incredibly important. And the price of healthcare insurance is important because even with subsidies and in some cases cost sharing, some of these copays and deductibles and premiums for people are a little hard to afford. So the affordability of the health law is incredibly important.
Well, on that note, always a pleasure. You bring so much clarity to this issue. Mary Agnes Carey, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. She's a reporter for Kaiser Health News. And we began our conversation with Mark Levy, a Pennsylvania political reporter for the Associated Press, talking about another important but slightly wonky issue having to do with pensions here in the Commonwealth. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out much more about this program, including following us on Facebook and Twitter and downloading podcasts of the program. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.